This is Bloomberg Business of Sports.
COVID has been so devastating. And to see 38,000 people at Fenway Park, it was really emotional and rewarding.
On the business side, from ticket sales to jersey sales, revenues were up. Everything was really good. It was a really solid year.
I realized that at the beginning of 2019, it would be a very unique opportunity in terms of a lot of contracts being up at the same time and a lot of exciting young wrestlers being available to go out and start a wrestling company.
The country is finally deeply getting the memo about how amazing this sport is. I think the sky's the limit for MLS.
Bloomberg Business of Sports
from Bloomberg Radio.
Hello, this is the Bloomberg Business of Sports show where we explore the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Michael Clark.
I'm Scarlett Fu.
And I'm Mike Lynch.
Coming up today, we catch up with Todd DuBoeuf, president of Top Rank. That's the boxing promotion behind legendary fighters like Muhammad Ali and Sugar Ray Leonard, and more recently, Tyson Fury. That's straight ahead on the Bloomberg Business of Sports show, but first, let's look at some of the top stories of the week. And let's start with the Chinese video streaming giant Tencent. They've cut the live broadcast this week of the NBA game between the Celtics and the New York Knicks, and it's because of comments made by Enes Kanter.
My message to the Chinese government is free Tibet.
And Scar, that comment caused a whole lot of problems in China. Angry fans, and they called for a boycott.
It did, because he made some pro-Tibet comments. He also denounced China's President Xi Jinping as a brutal dictator. This was all over the course of a three-minute video where he slammed Xi Jinping and then criticized China's rule over Tibet, saying Tibet belongs to the Tibetan people. He was wearing a black T-shirt with an image of the Dalai Lama, and he said that he could no longer stay silent. And of course, China-Tibet relations, very sensitive. China reacted immediately, and Tencent removed all live streaming for upcoming Celtics games. This is not the first time that the NBA has found itself in hot water in China, because a couple years ago, in 2019, the Houston Rockets' general manager, Daryl Morey, tweeted out support of pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong, and that sparked a huge backlash in China.
And Lindsay, Scarlett just said it, we've seen this movie before, and we thought the NBA, keep your thoughts on the down low, but it didn't happen.
No, and I know Enes Kanter, he's a Muslim, he's from Turkey, and we did an interview with the ABC affiliate in Boston a few years ago with him when he spoke out against the Turkish government, and he still had family over there, and an arrest warrant was actually issued for him 4 years ago. So this will not be the last we'll hear from Enes Kanter, I promise you.
I mean, this matters too, Barr, also, because the NBA is hugely popular in China. It's the most popular U.S. sports league. Forget the MLB, forget the NHL. It's all about the NBA. The NBA's business in China is a billion-dollar enterprise, and we've seen from superstars like LeBron, you tread carefully in China.
Well, you just hit the nail on the head. There's a lot of money for the NBA and NBA players to be made in China, and that's why a lot of the players have been, like you said, treading lightly.
And NBA Commissioner Adam Silver had his State of the League address on Tuesday, and he expected revenues to hit or exceed $10 billion. And that was before the Celtics stream was pulled by Tencent over in China. So maybe that this $10 billion projection by Adam Silver will be directly affected by this move.
How many meetings do you think he's having with his lawyers right now?
Oh, my goodness.
Can they patch this up? I mean, can we get by this?
He's got to apologize, or China's going to want Kanter to apologize in a very straightforward way, in a very clear-cut way, and immediately. And I'm sure they want the NBA to denounce what he said as well.
Let's talk about something a little more happier if you are an NFL fan. My goodness gracious, the rating numbers for the NFL, 16.6 million viewers per game through week 6. That's doing something, Lindsay.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons for that. Number one, there's some great new quarterbacks this year that are in, so a lot of teams that didn't have a great deal of interest now do, even teams that just won their first game like Jacksonville. You get Justin Fields with the Chicago Bears. You get Mac Jones with the New England Patriots, and on and on. But I've been saying this for weeks. this new, all these new gambling apps that people have on their phones have all these different props. Before, you just made a bet before the game. I'm going to take the over, or I'm going to take the Jets, and I'm going to take 7.5 points. Now you can go right to the final whistle, till 0-0-0, to say, all right, here's the odds on the Jets making a first down on this possession. So people are watching games, and they're hanging in there to the end of the games. They're going past the click points, which is where they measure the total audience for a game. And I think there's a direct correlation between all these betting apps and the uptick in attendance.
Scarlett, if we sat down and we said, okay, you got $5, and you saw the app online to bet on an NFL game, and it's, you know, the Detroit Lions, which are undefeated. The 0-6 Detroit Lions, would you have interest in the game?
I suppose if I was bored by the game and nothing else was happening, I might just see what happens. And I guess that's how they get people in there, right? I mean, they're looking to entice all kinds of different fans and different spectators to see who bites. And it might be the lifelong Detroit Lions fan, Bar, or it might be me, who's kind of just glancing at the score every once in a while. But they want to keep you engaged.
We got to take a big shout out. When your name is Ty Washington, you're doing good, and you better be good, and he is good. Lynchy, he did got an NIL deal with a Porsche dealership.
Yeah, and he's on his Twitter account or Instagram. I can't remember which one it was. It doesn't really matter.
There's probably both at this point, right?
Yeah, he's sitting in an $80,000 Porsche. And this was my biggest fear when this name, image, and likeness came out. There's going to be a huge chasm between the haves and the have-nots, and I think it's going to divide a lot of teams.
Yeah, because the best players immediately will get all these deals, and everyone else will be looking on from the side. And at the end of the day, they're all playing on the same team, but one looks like a professionally paid player, and everyone else is students.
Yeah, one guy's driving an $80,000 Porsche to practice. Three other guys are riding their bicycles.
Well, you're playing at Kentucky, so obviously you have a high-profile college that you're playing for.
I say shame on the car dealer. What is the attraction to have a kid who has never played a game of college basketball yet and giving him an $80,000 car and some type of agreement?
He's going to drive around town in that car.
Yeah. And it's going on the back of it. It's going to say, you know, Scarlett Wool Porsche, come on down.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sure. Today, we are speaking with Todd DeBuff, president of boxing promoter Top Rank, the organization behind WBC heavyweight champ Tyson Fury, who just came off a spectacular 11th round victory against Deontay Wilder. Listen.
Taking supernatural strength.
Fury for the body.
And that's it. It's over. Russell Moore waves it off. He's not counting. The Gypsy King is the heavyweight champion of the world.
Well, Todd, welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you. You just gave me goosebumps with that audio insert. I wasn't expecting that.
We're all about the emotion here.
Oh, yeah. We bring it. We try to bring it all the time.
All right. Well, I got goosebumps on that one.
Well, that brings me to my first question. I'm an old school guy. Boxing, I used to love boxing. I couldn't wait. Especially like in the early 70s, is like, you know, I'm going to tune in. I'm going to see Muhammad Ali. I'm going to see Joe Frazier. I'm going to see all these guys. And then all of a sudden, it almost, boxing became like a niche sport, because I don't know if it's because of the MMA or what happened. What happened to boxing, and where can it come back to where we had the old days of the Gillette cavalcade of sports?
Well, I mean, I think that's a really, really you know, good question. I don't want to bore you with what happened to it, but it's so obvious when I tell you. You know, what happened was we had the advent of new media that came involved. And as a result of you waking up as a child with your father, grandfather, whoever it was, that watched, even listened on the radio to baseball and boxing in the early 1900s, and then the beginning of television and the Gillette Friday Night Series out of New York, and then ABC, NBC, and CBS just always had fights on coming out of the Olympics in the 70s. You know, premium cable television, meaning HBO at that time, came in and said, listen, we can grab a piece of a sport that can help drive subs. We're going to overpay and take it to a smaller platform. And that really became the separation between mainstream, where mass quantities of viewers could watch it on free-to-air television, to a niche sport where people had to pay to go behind a paywall to go in and see it. And as a result of that, it built up the helped build up subscribers for premium cable television, but it actually was the detriment to becoming mainstream for the general enthusiast.
That's so interesting. I had not thought about how paid television, paid cable, is responsible for the demise of boxing as a mainstream sport that exposed it to a much wider audience. I mean, I'm in Michael Barr's camp, which is, I remember the days when everyone used to talk about boxing and then it kind of just disappeared off the face of the earth. Mm-hmm. Is part of it because we don't have a American undisputed heavyweight champion that can really promote the sport in the way, I mean, I remember Mike Tyson and I remember how he was in the culture. He was, you know, everyone talked about him. Everyone knew what he was about. I feel like we don't have that right now.
Well, I think, I used to say that Mike Tyson's is boxing's Truman Show, right? He's just like, we watched everything in his life, you know, very similar to the movie. I don't think it's isolated to boxing. I think what it's isolated to the amount of content that there exists today and the amount of headwinds everybody has to really cut through a lot of the distractions and the niches that are going on there, right? So you have so much content out there today. You have from your social platforms that are now competition to eyeballs. Back in the day, we only had four channels that we were programming. So you were forced to watch a certain, a football game or a basketball game or a boxing match or the Partridge Family. You didn't have 600 channels and all these options and wireless communication that you could go on to YouTube and watch, get content. So I think that's all part of the challenge. I don't believe it's isolated to boxing, right? I remember as much as Magic and Bird being, like these incredible godlike figures when they came out of the NCAA and played each other in the Final Four, right? We're not seeing that today. Does that mean it's an indictment of basketball? No, it's just the way that we're connecting to all the viewers out there is very different and much more difficult.
When I was growing up as a kid and in college and even afterwards, the most respected and revered moniker in all of sports was heavyweight champion of the world. And we could rattle off every name from Joe Louis, Rocky Marciano, Floyd Patterson, Ali, Frazier, Foreman, Larry Holmes, Tyson, Holyfield. I bet if you ask the average sports fan today who's the heavyweight champion of the world, how many out of 10 do you think would get the answer?
I probably think that, it depends what country you are in.
Yeah.
I think in the United States, I think you would struggle to get the answer from probably if it was 30 to 40% of them. I think if you went to the UK, I think everybody in Europe would know it. And I think this is, again, what we were talking about earlier in the podcast, right? In this show,
yeah.
Right? This is the amount of competition that all sports properties are fighting for to get eyeballs and get fans. It is just, it's an epidemic. There is so much content. When you start looking outside of the United States landscape and you start looking in Europe and you start looking in Asia and you start looking in Latin America, I mean, the number one sport in the world is soccer. Number two is combat sports in general, right? It is just that big. The whole category is that big. And boxing is probably up at the top of that because it's an Olympic sport that goes back hundreds of years. That's not it. Just because it doesn't exist and we think like this, it doesn't rise to the top in America. It means that it's not as relevant anywhere else, but it's very relevant.
Well, speaking of combat sports, where is boxing's place in the combat sports landscape, not just here in the U.S., but abroad?
Well, I think, when you look at boxing in general, you have a very historical architecture that has been put in place for many, many years. And I'm going back 100 years, like I just mentioned, it was an Olympic sport. As a result of that, you have these kids that come out of the Olympics. If it was a Lomachenko that carried the flag for the Ukraine, or Sugar Ray Leonard in Canada when he won the gold medal, right, out of, Montreal, you remember those moments, or George Foreman in Mexico, right? You remember the moments where your Olympians represented your country, right? I think we keep looking at this from the prism of the United States, and I think from the prism of the United States, we have a struggling amateur system. We have our Olympics, our Olympic sport, boxing, isn't put on the top tier for exposure, right? And we're putting on more track and field. We're putting on other properties that NBC puts on. And therefore, it kind of struggles with its natural progression for that being the foundation of building champions. Globally, it crushes it. Boxing is as robust as ever because there's a fighter that comes from a country. They have represented it, and they connect with their country, and they connect with everybody there. So I think in the U.S., again, we struggle a little bit with that because of all the options we have. But I think internationally, it works really well.
And this is a good time to talk about pay-per-view. And you brought it up earlier in the show. When cable television came into play, it kind of messed up pay-per-view as more cable outlets came into play, because it wasn't even pay-per-view back in the day. It was just called closed circuit. And you would go to the arena and you'd watch it on a screen. What has changed now with pay-per-view, and is there a business model for it today in boxing?
Yeah, I think when we talk about the shift for the programs or the shift from media landscape with boxing, what happened was its mainstay, meaning the size of the boxing product, was put behind a paywall. Now, there's always been a paywall in boxing for a closed circuit, like it was when you went to the theaters at the highest level. So for those marquee events, you paid for them and you went to a theater in the old days, right? And then it became distributed in the 80 million pay-per-view homes, and you spent, you know, 69 or 79, or in Mayweather Pacquiao's, it was $100, and you did 4.6 million buys. It was crazy, right? So there's always been that tiered system. So I think in today's world, what we're seeing is that there is a much more profound relationship between the digital providers, the direct-to-consumer providers, than there is with the cable operators and dishes. And I think that's really where we're seeing the delta. We're seeing a much more robust, responsive pay platform being built through DTC than we are through the cable operators that are still just delivering broadband to all your homes. So the results of our pay universe is now having a much more profound and responsive result to the sports fans that are connected to direct-to-consumers, like the Netflixes of the world, or in our case, it's ESPN Plus that is our distributor for most of our fights.
What do the profit margins look like for pay-per-view versus streaming overall versus being on network television, which I know is back in the day? I'm just curious if you could break it down for us.
Well, our perspective is it varies very differently, right? Because we have to take the risk associated with guaranteeing the fighters the revenues, their guarantees. So each of those big pay-per-view events, right, has it sits on a a la carte basis, other than what our media rights deal is currently with ESPN and Disney. So we provide about roughly 30 shows, not including pay-per-view shows, and our library and shoulder programming and the whole verticals, boxing vertical, to ESPN, Disney, ESPN Plus, and you get the regular shows for that. Mm-hmm. And we provide that, and you get to see the Teofimo Lopez's or the Lomachenkos of the world or the Tyson Furies who comes over to the U.S. and fights twice on ESPN Plus and expose them to. On pay-per-view, that's a different model. That's an a la carte model. And, you know, it depends on the deals that you make with the fighters and the athletes and your costs associated with that. So there is no formulaic, you know, profit margin, you know, system that's set up for the pay-per-view.
It's bespoke then.
Yeah, 100% bespoke, and depends on the profit participation of the athletes and, you know, what their guarantees are.
Todd, how does Top Rank, the gold standard in my book, how does it measure a successful fight? Is it strictly on pay-per-view subscriptions?
No, we're only looking, when you say that, I look at the whole body of work as success, right? I felt like we made a big move I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago when we said, listen, we see the model shifting. Let's bring boxing back to the masses and let's make this deal with ESPN and bring it to you. You know, so we're on SportsCenter all the time. We're in the chatter with the radio shows all the time. And we're running across the tape on the bottom all the time. We were disconnected from that. So first thing is I want to see boxing be successful, and I want you to know all of these fighters' names, right? I want you to know like you said, you don't think how many people out of 10 sports fans can name the heavyweight champion of the world. I want to see 9 out of 10 know who that is. So I don't look at it as just a successful one night. I look at it as a successful putting our arms around the brand and elevating the sport. On the bigger fights, like we just had with Wilder and Fury, the third fight, the success of that was a number of reasons. One is, was it a good fight, right? And everybody was on the edge of their seat, and everybody was talking about how this could have been one of the greatest heavyweight fights and one of the best fights they'd seen in many, many decades. That's wonderful success. Two, decisive ending. Decisive endings always make a difference. I can't stand the rhetoric. I think we kind of shoot ourselves in the foot when you have a bad decision associated with a big fight because consumer confidence goes low. I feel like I don't understand the judging. I don't understand the scoring. And then they make up all this stuff. Yeah. So those are the two things. And then I think the third piece is the economics of how much awareness did we create? How much did people tune into it? How much pay-per-view did you do? What was your live game? What was your international? And I think those are the economics around it. But I think you really have to look at action in the ring, decisive ending, and revenue streams to create a successful one-off event.
Todd, I have a question for you. When it comes to boxing, I don't like watching it because I don't like seeing men get punched in the face. It reminds me of concussions. I have a hard enough time watching my kids play hockey as it is. I love hockey, but it's hard to think about the fact that someone's getting bashed in the head. Yet, I love boxing because I work out. It's a fitness craze. Does the fact that boxing is a fitness craze help or hurt you? Because on the one hand, it opens up the sport to a younger, more diverse audience, a broader audience, female audience. But at the same time, people might have a reaction like me where you don't want to actually see people get bashed in the head.
I think it definitely opens up a broader audience. And I think what we're seeing is in the current study we just saw, you know, within Gen Z's, boxing is ranking number 4. And within millennials, we're number 5 sport in the country. Now, that's fantastic.
To watch or to participate in or to
watch,
work out to?
To watch, that are fans, that mm-hmm. are general fans. Mm-hmm. And this skew going younger and more broad is about all those touch points that we just discussed, right? One is making it more readily available. Two is also, you know, people love the fitness side of it. And we see our women's category growing immensely, right? Where people are, maybe some women aren't offended by, you know, the violence as you are, or, you know, or some people or men aren't offended by it and they want to see it. But then when they can do the sport, it makes them get closer to the sport. So if somebody can punch a heavy bag or a speed bag or do the mitts with a trainer or jump rope, there's an appreciation for what they see. No different than I was a kid playing basketball, right? I used to pick up a basketball. If I could do what I saw the UNLV Running Rebels do, mm-hmm. I thought it was great. It connected me to them. So I think those touch points are all part of expanding the sport. And we see that more people are involved, and we see, you know, entertainers and people like my guys will come to me and say, Halle Berry's posting a lot of boxing stuff on Instagram that she's like training and boxing. I love that, right? It just expands it and makes it more fast.
I mean, yeah, following on that, a lot of other athletes use boxing as a way to stay in shape and to elevate their workouts. I think about hockey players. I'm a big New York Rangers fan, and they'll always post videos of the guys boxing, shadow boxing, doing a lot of workouts as a way to stay in shape, just to kind of give you a glimpse into their workout.
Absolutely. I mean, you'll see guys like Dame Lillard, who's always like posting on boxing, and he likes to box himself. And we love to see that. The question is, and then what happens is when there's a fight, a big fight, and they're watching, you'll see all of a sudden these guys have started engaging on the social platforms like, oh, what a punch, or what an amazing fighter. You know, Rosie Perez, the actress, is always on the social platforms and watching every fight and glued in. So this is all part of, you know, that narrative that I was talking about earlier, is expanding the reach of the sport and touching so many of a much broader base by being in more mainstream.
Hey, Todd, I should point out that your stepdad is the iconic Bob Arum, who has I had the good fortune to work with in a lot of the Marvin Hagler fights in the 1980s. What's the most important lesson that your stepdad, Bob Arum, has taught you as you've taken over Top Rank?
I think, you know what, if you look at Bob, he's like he's a history book within a history book, right? He just is, he has gone from the 60s with the Nation of Islam and Muhammad Ali to, and seen everything changed, right? To Close Circuit, to Ray Leonard and Marvin Hagler and Tommy Hearns, to, you know, the Hispanic boom in the late 80s and with Michael Carvajal in the 90s with De La Hoya and Mayweather we signed out of the Olympics. I think what what he taught me the most was, keep moving, right? Don't get stuck in your ways and keep moving forward. And if you look at it, they had to keep moving forward, right? They went from a closed circuit model to then general pay-per-view model, which was cable. They kept moving forward. Look at the, you know, the boom of the Hispanics, and always just keep moving forward. And I think that to me was, you know, he was a brilliant, brilliant lawyer. That's what his original training was. And he, you know, and as a trained as a litigator, but he always was looking to keep moving forward. And, you know, look at the success. When he looked at me and said, oh, Manny Pacquiao is going to be huge, I'm like, what? I couldn't see it. Right. I just couldn't. Sometimes you could see it. Like, this is, you know, he is the Clive Davis or the Jimmy Iovine of the music business, right? He knows how to make a star and create a star. And he taught us how to do that. But he also taught us how to do that looking forward. And he has a wonderful crystal ball we could all use.
I know talking about business at the dinner table is a no-no sometimes, but I got to ask about this guy, Terrence Crawford. He is undefeated, 37-0. And right now, with Top Rank, the WBO welterweight champion, his last fight under contract scheduled, for November 20th against Sean Porter. So what happens next? What do you do with Terrence Crawford?
I mean, Terrence we've had for a long time, and he's a terrific, terrific fighter from Omaha, Nebraska. Rated, everybody has him in the top two pound for pound. And I think for him, this is a real tough fight. He's got Sean Porter, who everybody's been clamoring for and is a really tough welterweight. And he's going to have to put on see what he can do. I think it's a really difficult fight. And, you know, when those opportunities, when that door opens, it's time for him to step through and see how he handles Sean Porter. Sean has been in with everybody and is going to back him up and is really strong and tough. And Terrence is going to have to figure out what he wants to do in the fight to dictate the pace. It's going to be a very difficult fight. And I think what you do is we sit down after the fight and we have a conversation with Terrence about what he wants to do with his future and where his future lies. You know, the division right now for in the welterweights, there's obviously Errol Spence who's injured right now, Pacquiao who's retired. So right now the Spence fight is the biggest fight for him. And we'll see on November 20th how it performs and how he does.
I think about boxing and I think about Vegas. You're based in Vegas. With more sports betting happening, and I mean, Michael Barr's listening to this with ears
ding, ding,
perked up. I mean, are your ears perked up?
Oh,
they are.
Perked. They're like a German shepherd. You need to see them right
there
now.
You go. Todd, talk a little bit about what you're projecting when it comes to revenue and exposure from the explosion in sports gambling, sports betting.
Well, I mean, I think if you saw on the Fury Wilder fight, you know, FanDuel had a massive presence. They were a big sponsor for us. And we are now getting the aftermath of what the success was. They have represented that it was a big success for them, and we want to get more granular in this. This is a whiteboard for everybody in sports. And
what do you mean it's a whiteboard?
Well, I mean that each sport is different, right? And I think that for us, and for boxing, they haven't, you know, and FanDuel came in and said, listen, let's try to put up different propositions during the action, right? In between rounds, change the odds of the fight instantaneously, right? So all of a sudden, you know, all of a sudden there were odds where after the second round, Fury knocks down Wilder, and the odds went higher. They posted the odds way high for Fury to win, where Wilder was an underdog. Then all of a sudden in the fourth round, Fury gets knocked down twice and the odds flip instantaneously. That never happened in my era, right? That never happened in the old box, in the old gambling. You either made a bet at the beginning of the fight before the the bell rang, and you said, this guy's going to win this many rounds or whatever it is. That was it. So now the whole concept of micro bets, data collection, the whole concept of making it instantaneously and getting more people, more of the young demographics engaged in that, I think the sky's the limit, and we don't know exactly what we don't know how big it's going to be yet, and we don't know how successful it's going to be yet and how we're going to execute on it, but we do know there has to be a seamless interaction between the content holder and the graphics and the messaging that are go back to the viewer so they can instantaneously play along the game with micro bets.
Yeah, back in the day, you didn't have the online betting. You had Benny the bookie, and that was it. And then you asked, all right, how much can you give me on the Frazier fight? And that was pretty much it. Online gambling has changed everything, like you said.
Yeah, and I think the thing about it that's even more fascinating is that it's engaging people on a different rate, right? So you're getting this continual action that's being proposed to you while the action is going on. And that micro bet nature is what people are projecting. I think we all think it is going to do is it's going to keep people glued into the television. It's going to keep ratings up. It's what we saw from fantasy sports, right? People started watching games just to see their athletes itself, right? And I think we see that same projection in all live sports. And really it's executing how we could give micro bet propositions with the gambling online sports books as your partner in this next chapter.
Todd, talk to me about social media. For many years, we thought boxing might be a dying sport like horse racing, but obviously it's surging right now. What role did social media play in the comeback of Boston boxing?
Well, I think we embraced it. I think one of the things, if you look at if you just said to me, and we were on the hot seat, and you say, Todd, you have a business, you have matchmakers that make matches, you have people that put on the events, you have all this stuff. Where was your biggest growth? And I would tell you right now, my biggest growth was internal social media strategy and production. Owning my own content, creating my own content, using all the platforms and executing it on plans, right? We used to need to have networks or newspapers in the old days to give us awareness to our product. Now we don't need that anymore. We have all of our channels that are activated that can go to a global basis and be programmed for social media. One of the peak. I mean, just so you know, on the weekend of Wilder Fury, we were by far the biggest of sporting event of everything that was on that weekend, which included two NL division championship games, National League, which included Texas A&M and Alabama, which included the Bills in Kansas City, which included a Penn State game. We destroyed them on the social chatter and platforms. And I think two things exist. One is its relevance in the U.S. and one of its global level. There is no global level to those other sports like there is for a boxing match when you have people coming from the league. So we embrace social platforms. We embrace it as a monetization model and an awareness model. And I think you're going to see more and more stuff, really using those platforms as a way to connect to more fans. And it makes your demographic go younger when you do use those correctly.
Todd DeBuff, president of Top Rank Boxing. You got me all tingly now just to see the ring come back as the dominant again. Thank you, sir, for joining us. It was a great conversation.
Hey, guys, I really appreciate it. And I'd love for all of you to come out to a fight one day, even if you think it's barbaric and you don't like to see him get punched.
Well,
I tell you this, there's nothing like the energy
nothing
of a major prize fight. Nothing. There is nothing like it. You can go to the Kentucky Derby. You can go to the seventh game of a World Series or an NBA championship or the Super Bowl. The energy of when those two fighters, when those guys walk out of the dressing rooms and they enter the stadium and the whole arena stands, unlike anything else in all of sports. So let's do it.
Thank you, Todd. Yeah, appreciate it.
Todd LaBeouf, I'm not kidding. I mean, I get chills just thinking about the ring and boxing and this. Like, it's coming back. I believe it in all my heart. So I'm going to ask Scarlett, would you watch boxing? And I know how you feel about boxing, but would you watch it? The Olympic boxing. Let's start with that. Would you watch it?
I've tried watching it, and it's kind of exciting, like Todd said, when I can recognize that someone's throwing a left hook, but I don't like how violent it is. I don't mind, you know, throwing the punches myself into the air or against the bag. But what I thought was fascinating from our conversation with him is this idea that the modern media market, the paid TV, the cable television, prestige TV, all of that is one reason why boxing has become such a niche sport. I never thought about it that way. And it's kind of like boxing is the early test case for the fragmentation of the media market.
Lindsay, what did you take away from it?
Well, I agree with that because we used to have the Friday night fights on Gillette, as we talked in our conversation. Muhammad Ali fought on Wide World of Sports on free television on Saturday afternoons many, many times. Now you have to really search and hunt and pay a lot of money to watch a championship boxing match. But Todd claims that boxing is as robust as ever and is right now the number five sport. Most popular sport in the United States, that behind obviously football, basketball, baseball, and hockey.
The thing about boxing, and I want people to understand, this is nothing new. When we talk about streaming this or TV that, trust me, everybody huddled around a radio to hear a boxing match many years ago in the 40s. So this is nothing new. What's happening now is how can this sport get back to not being a niche sport anymore and just good old watching a sport, which I grew up with.
And that was a question I had. I mean, is it more profitable as a niche sport, or is it better off as a mainstream sport?
Right. You need some personalities. You need a Rocky Marciano, a Muhammad Ali, a Joe Frazier, a Sugar Ray Leonard, a Marvin Hagler, a Thomas Hearns. You need a personality, somebody that is a carnival barker and can sell their own fights like Ali did.
My goal is to be the number one pick. That's something I've been dreaming of since a kid.
It feels better to be number one than number five.
I wear the number because of Mike.
We have a chance to go for three in a row.
Good numbers at a good time.
When I first started wearing that number, I was just happy and proud.
Bloomberg Business of Sports, the number of the week.
Here's the number, Equinox. Their gyms are frequented by Wall Street staffers, among others. They're in talks to go public through a merger with Ares Acquisition. What I want to know is, Ares Acquisition raised this much in February in its initial public offering.
Lynchy, you go first.
Yeah, Lynchy, you go first.
Oh, boy. I'll go, it's going to be $100 million. I'll go $120 million.
Scarlett?
$150.
They raised $1 billion in its February initial public offering. So by the Price is Right rules, Scarlett.
Oh, finally. Even though I'm still so far away from the actual number.
Hey, you still made Plinko. That's good. This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports show. We hear each and every week at the same time, plus online. Wherever you get your podcast, you can catch those Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. I'm Michael Barr on Twitter at Big Barr Sports.
And I'm graciously handing over the trophy to Scarlett, but only for 1 week. I'm Mike Lynch. You can follow me at LynchyWCBB.
And you can follow me on Twitter at ScarlettFu, where I will be bragging all week about having won the number of the week.
And I'm not going to let Lynchy forget it. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again next week for the latest on the stories moving big money in the world of sports. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Sports Radio around the world.